Thanks so much, Anthony. Hello, and thanks so much to you all for being here. It feels odd to begin a presentation like this without just saying Martin Harrison first up, because many of you will know we lost him this week or over the weekend. It's been a tremendously sad week, but also a terrific time for the Australian poetry community to reflect on the contribution that he made as a thinker and a poet and a teacher in poetics. So he's so much in my mind, and in a way this I feel like dedicating everything that I say today to him, which I will. And a little bit of an introduction. It's nice to have a chance to both see this as a formal paper but also a more relaxed presentation. And I really am at a point with this project where I would love some hard criticism. So please feel free to treat me as your student and critique my methodology. Come on in, guide me, please. I don't mean that in a selfish way and don't feel pressured, but I'm ready for some extra ears and eyes around this thinking if you feel like you have them. So a little bit of an introduction to the paper itself. I wrote this in July for the Contemporary Women's Writing Association conference, a conference in Melbourne held by an international network of scholarship and scholars around women's writing. And it was a marvellous conference with keynotes drawn from a very broad kind of interdisciplinary field, including Lynn Hajinian, who many of you met in July, Deborah Bird Rose, who spoke beautifully again about, you know, contemporary environments and habitats, Kate Rigby, and Chris Krauss, the New York-based academic. So it was very broad, and the general idea was about poetry or environments and habitats, writing environments. So I wanted to respond to, I guess, my local writing habitat, but also some recent returns in philosophical thinking to thing theory, if you might call it that, or thinking about objects again, thinking about things. And I guess there's a dialogue been happening through writing society also, through the work of ex-students like Tom Lee and the visit of Stephen Connor, who I'm going to work, you know, with some of his ideas in this paper. So there's been a lot going on about figuring, I guess, subjectivities that might be other than human or other than subjective. And this is a challenge that's coming out of thinking through ecologies and also thinking about ontologies and broader environments for philosophy after the work of someone like Latour, who's talking about actor network theory, which started to, again, bring to the fore ideas of concepts of materiality that include the other than anthropocentric, I guess. So I was thinking about these ideas. The larger project around this paper some of you will be aware of, and that is that over the last several years I've been developing a series of critical papers offering very close readings of contemporary Australian poetries that you might place into a trajectory of innovative or experimental poetry and poetics. And a notoriously difficult thing to define or categorise, but I'm interested in innovations in form and genealogies of alternative cultural models, I guess, and poets in Australia who appear to have, I guess, reading and writing affinities with key moments of what you might think of as avant-garde practice in Western poetics and literature. So I've been trying for some time to kind of work this into a larger project, and in a bigger sense I'd like this to be a book about poetics as a way of thinking, you know, these broader kind of ontologies around poetic practice and why I still think there are real issues at stake in proposing new critical vocabularies around Australian poetry. And there seems to be always a renewed need to put pressure on particular categories that seem to be persistent and somewhat reflexive, I guess, in critical analysis, and they include things like awkward, I suppose, bifurcations between lyric and language, or mainstream and experimental, or even sort of transcendent materialist. I'm always interested in those categories and why we use them. We turn to them often in the Australian literary critical vocabulary. And a little note, following Anthony's note on practice-led research, I'm going to give this paper, in a sense, in two parts. First, a formal paper. And secondly, I'm going to read a long poem that I wrote at the same time. I'd been commissioned to write a piece of work as part of a sequence of poems celebrating Overland's 60th anniversary. And I wrote a poem called Thinking with Things that's dedicated to Pam Brown. And it's the alternative essay to this essay that I'm going to read, in a sense. So I just wanted to... I've been working more closely of late with the music department over at Penrith on ideas of what constitutes practice-led research. And I wanted to... A frequent question that came up a week and a half ago when I was mentoring a lot of HDR candidates in music was, is there such thing as an identifiable creative moment or artistic moment? And I kept wanting to ask about the conceptual moment and the critical moment as well, because a lot of the conversation around feeling and the feeling of artistic expression seemed to subtly reinforce that idea that a conceptual sublime was different to an artistic or emotional sublime in some way. And this sort of thing interests me very much. And I kind of want to think about critical work as a creative act of improvisation in the field of ideas. I love that idea. I find it very rich and rewarding. So I'm going to show you, I suppose, just diverse ways in which I tried to address the core thinking of this paper, just because I've got the luxury of some time this morning. And to think about even whether the doing of thinking in a critical paper is actually different to the doing of thinking within a poem. And if that's the case, why is that the case? Is that even interesting? So I'll get to the paper itself, Thinking with Things, by way of showing you two of the poems that I read closely, or at least little snippets into them, because I gathered that wouldn't be familiar to all of you. This is the poem by Astrid Laronge that I am reading closely. It's called One Is Also Chips. And let's just have a look at the first section. It's a very long poem. This is just a taste. I am the line itself, a small as thin piece in hewing or cutting, the course of a woodman's work. I am a woodman's chip. He broke dates, sodden then dry for a blaze. On the ground, the parsley's a sapling, the tile of a battle of turpentine. I love you. I love as I am embedded in a doughy earlobe next to your brain. Poets in their German workshops, their fracture of a potato as scorched in molten fats, orange wedges, a salt cellar, the tug of Dickens at the back of the throat. I am so thirst, and I am just like my mother, betrayed by cunning sources, a piece of money, a willing to pile, straddling a driver, straddling one who plays that damn insurance game. One wishes to close your circuit, to root all nervous systems and tech gear through my palm, as though sopped into bread. Inside every cell is a system beyond your own capacity for mathematics. Inside every wire is a bloodline beyond our sense of community. You whom thy fingers walk, I walked into the space inside your downy cat's ear, folded as an envelope between my finger pads, threaded as hats into baskets, one thing filleted from another to add strength, threading as mutton or dung of buffalo, skin of gravy, a potato, a grammatical device. And this book was published 3 years back by the wonderfully titled Tea Party Republicans Press out of New York. Again, it made me think, what are the critical vocabularies that we can take to a work like this being produced in Australia, obviously with a resonance to an American context at this time? And here's the beginning of the poem, one of the poems from Pam Brown that I'll be looking at, from her 2002 work Text Thing that came out with Ken Bolton's Little S the Books a good decade ago. This and that, I cite myself. I always hear Chrissy Amphlett behind that title. Resting like a relic in a field of meaning, push the rocks around for transformation, gravel, rash, scab, scar, all factors that fall squarely like that. Those well-known codes, public-private continuum, a surveyor's tripod clacks, the laneway reduced and framed is picturesque, even the rubbish appears artificial. Okay. The word habitat is associated most often with living matter. Habitats are places of linkage, environments that sustain and are built by living things. But what happens when we imagine poems as habitats for all and anything, whether sentient or not? Contemporary Australian poets Astrid Laronge and Pam Brown both write thingly poetries. Both display an intense and tender regard for nouns as they verb. Both revel in arrays of lists. In Astrid Laronge's supercharged works, objects and bodies impress upon and are arranged alongside others in teeming ecologies. Material and conceptual transformations occur as poems enable what literary and cultural theorist John Froe has called an endless mixing of the properties of persons with the properties of things. This is figured in Laronge's poem Wolves Are Swarms, also from that chapbook. And Astrid writes, I just said I am a swarm of impressions. I just said this is a suite of dirty little wolves, the simple hidden swarm of events and actors, determined by the outer shell, emitting light, filling orbits, you as a fennel bulb. In a connected fashion, Pam Brown's poems play with a sense of poetic texts themselves as other than human objects, even as they are written by and gifted between people. Via a series of conditional naming exercises, Brown meditates on poetry as a habitat in which others and things can exchange belongings without being appropriated. And she writes, this poem, merely a hint of the trove of things, it's nothing really. So I want to respond to the different object fascinations of LaRonge and Brown as a way of improvising a mode of thinking with things. I'm interested in kinds of relational or collectivist aesthetics, and more particularly in ways that poems can be event horizons for affective subjects, or matrices of perception in which hosts of objects pressure subjects into continuous de and recomposition. LaRonge's poems effect thing swarms, complex scripts of material melange in which things bump against each other in swarms of impressions. Impressions are important here. An impression suggests networks of interrelation between objects, things, and subjects. For something to leave an impression, a transformation must occur, from materiality to afterimage, or from object to interpretive and necessarily subsequent sign. Conversely, impressions of things can be launched when the thing being re-performed or evoked is nowhere in proximity. There is no way to stabilise the manifold seething relationships between impressions and objects, or to insist upon the visible equivalence of their linked terms, as LaRonge knows when she refers to a hidden swarm of events and actors. Poetic impressions offer an acknowledgement of something posited recently by cultural theorist Stephen Connor. While making admiring readings of texts by Michel Serres, Connor claims that thing theory is understood best as a means of fathoming how objects and things, he makes minimal distinction, enable the becoming of subjects, since subjects qua subjects become so chiefly via their libidinal investment in certain objects. How does one become a subject? By means of the object one takes oneself for, argues Connor. Thinking beings can only ever accede to themselves, which is to say, become able to think about their own thinking via the accessory of things. That's Connor. So let's say a thing precedes a person's encounter with it. If a poem is a habitat in which things might be encountered via language, then things as they appear in poetry might always be impressions, not stand-ins for actualities or representations of a temporarily obscured real, but indices to materialities or signs that point to scenes of encounter between objects and apprehending subjects. Objects press upon perception. Perception presses back. Material impressions collide, generating borders anew. Or as LaRonge writes, your nervous system decentralized, and so your intelligence spread across me, spread into volcanic soil. The figure of a thing swarm inspires a flock of questions. If a poem is a thing of things, or a habitat for a poetics of objects, how can poetry offer ways of understanding the effective, mediated, and mutable relationships between objects and subjects, and encourage us to shuffle the borders of that ever-increasingly clumsy distinction? What can a poetics of things offer to our thinking about the mutually constitutive and reciprocally gifting experiences of writing and reading? How can an object-focused poetics help us to scrutinise anthropocentric claims about the unknowability or the excessive irreducibility of things? And what might such inquiries add to ongoing discussions about the uses, potentials, and political efficacy of a post-constructivist, radically materialist poetry, especially at a time when countless material ecologies are in crisis? These questions are not especially new, but their application within the field of contemporary Australian poetry and poetics is limited to date. You can see, in a way, I feel compelled to do a kind of, not a catch-up work, but a situation of the Australian contemporary moment in poetics within these broader discourses, which have been around for a long time. And Australian poetry deals with them in very radical, exciting ways because of our positioning, I think, within a lot of those discourses. And I feel like as critics, it's sometimes our responsibility simply to acknowledge what comes into being as it does, as it erupts with a kind of newness, and to place it into a field. So some of this is backtracking on placement work that would be familiar and possibly mundane to a lot of you. So these questions aren't especially new, but their application within a field of contemporary Australian poetry and poetics is limited to date. In an incisive overview of thing theory, published in 2001, Bill Brown gave something of a rallying cry for considering thinking and thingness as inseparable. And he wrote, "We want things to come before ideas, before theory, before the word, whereas they seem to persist in coming after, as the alternative to ideas, the limit to theory, victims of the word. If thinking the thing feels like an exercise in belatedness, the feeling is provoked by our very capacity to imagine that thinking and thingness are distinct." So I want to turn here to a close reading of Astrid LaRonge's One Is Also Chips, the opening poem in her chapbook Eating and Speaking. My aim is not to delimit specific meanings for Laurange's poem, but to think with the poem as a thing of things. And in this, I hope to short-circuit hermeneutical methods of reading that demand fixed answers to the problems of poems, and following Bill Brown's salutary advice, to avoid the trap of reifying poems as the limit or exception to theory, necessarily outside, transcending, or subsequent to ideas. Poem as thing as thinking, thinking as thing as poem. One is also Chips is scattered with sassy directives to readers that work as tongue-in-cheek cautionary tales about how to approach the rapidly morphing objects and subjects of the poem. A lesson in affect at the very least, counsels Laurange. This comes soon after it whips one into an auto-meringue, which in turn follows a provocative geomorphological directive. She says, I fit right into this archipelago. So do you. Laurange's title gives us multiple clues to the kinds of thought we might encounter within the poem and to the kinds of thinking readers might perform by taking up the poem's things as lessons and when considering its collocation of tropes as enabling tools and technologies. One is also Chips. A person is more than a person or subject. A person is also what it perceives. It is the things of which it speaks or writes and, as the poem repeatedly suggests, the things it reads and eats. One is also Chips. One is an infinite multiple. One times one times one equals one. One thing is many things or comprised of many different characteristics and conditions that are also things in themselves. I should footnote and say that Astrid's thinking here is very influenced by the work of Alfred North Whitehead. And she has a manuscript or a book coming out in a couple of months' time with Wesleyan called How Reading is Written, A Brief Index to Gertrude Stein. So she is thinking very closely about Whitehead's provocation that when something comes at you, it comes in a manifold plane of things that can be seen as things in themselves, like the sense of experience, the idea of the colour of the coat being blue is a thing, thingly in Whitehead's terms, as is the coat itself and your encounter with a body that might be wearing it. So Astrid has been thinking very closely about object qualities and the kind of multiplicity of things that come at us when we encounter and exchange with objects. So one thing is many things or comprised of many different characteristics and conditions that are also things in themselves. Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari's observations on the thing status of percepts are salient here. And they write, the thing or the work of art is a block of sensations. That is to say, it's a compound of percepts and affects. Laurange explores this idea of amalgamated composition via the trope of the chip. In her poem, a chip is also a fracture of a potato as scorched in molten fats. Or it's the tug of Dickens at the back of the throat, or a system. It's one thing filleted from another by means of a game, an axe, a pocket knife, thus removing small parts at a time. A chip suggests an excessive route map of virtual data encoded in an improbably small microenvironment. Chips accumulate and reaggregate when something is carved from something else. A chip off the old block carries its own genetic blueprints and ancestral heredities, even while being severed from them. A bloodline beyond our sense of community. A chip is atomic, orbital, other than toast, never had, with, off, bred, step-tet, etc. This is all from her work. To return to Deleuze and Guattari, chips are like a passage from the finite to the infinite, but also from territory to deterritorialization. Eating chips is Laurange's metonymic figure for relations among things that morph and transform continuously in infinite series. Perhaps most significantly for Laurange's thinking across eating and speaking, a chip is also a grammatical device. I want to look in more detail at how one is also chips permutes through its many object and subject chains to reach that temporary moment of arrival or organisation, beginning again at the beginning. I am the line itself, a small, thin piece in hewing or cutting, the course of a woodman's work. I am a woodman's chip. He broke dates, sodden then dry for a blaze. On the ground, the parsley's a sapling, the tile of a battle of turpentine. One wish is to close your circuit, to root all systems and tech gear through my palm as though sopped into bread. Inside every cell is a system beyond your own capacity for mathematics. And on we go, down to the grammatical device where she arrives after this exemplary listing, I guess. So Laurange's opening words here, I am the line itself, reflect her attention to kinds of portraiture. One is also chips, or rhetorically invested catalogues of subjective attributes. Herself is her subject, but only in as much as she posits a speaking subject that refuses to stabilise in the poem. Laronge's subject does not resemble a lyrical I think tank so much as a thinking thing pressured by multiple flight lines of objectivity and objecthood. The poem's way of apprehending and naming things puts forward the lyrical subject, the conduit and conductor of the poem, as an entity in flux that exchanges properties with numerous threaded others. Witness the subject's mutation through so many different states in the poem. I is chips, the lion, the proper name chip, an earlobe, thirst like a heron, an eggshell, a leaf curl, animated as a whiff. Things are subject to a like recombinant logic, threaded as hats into baskets, threading as mutton or dung of buffalo, skin of gravy, a potato, a grammatical device. So across this poem, subjects and objects are always in becoming as objects and subjects. They jostle for placement in language and thought as others alongside one another. This repeating scene of poetical encounter and transfer produces countless instances of estrangement and refamiliarisation within an imagined subject's embodied perceptual field, as suggested perhaps by the punning title of two other recent chapbooks by Laronge, Food Turns into Blood and Pussy, 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 What, What, or Ole Day, Ole Day. Echoes of Gertrude Stein's foundationally estranging and familiarising attention to objects and subject composition are loud throughout Eating and Speaking, and they are acknowledged in the book's dual epigraph, which cites several lines from Michel Serres's The Parasite, including the passage from the material to the logical occurs, together with the first three lines of Gertrude Stein's Christian Berat, which was written in 1928, and it appeared later in Stein's book Portraits and Prayers from 1934. And this is that epigraph. Eating is her subject, while eating is her subject, where eating is her subject. Laronge's epigraph extends the conceptual potential of One Is Also Chips as a form of post-Steinian portraiture, where the noun, subject, is always verbing, movement and meta-transformation, troped here as eating. Arguably, the real subjects of such a rhetorical blazon are grammar and its materials, the rules and systems that generate logic and differentiation in language, or as Stein might write, arrangements in a system to pointing. One is also a grammatical device. One is a unit of subjective containment within a larger scheme of classification, as Laronge reminds us. Inside every cell is a system beyond your own capacity for mathematics. But one is also a sign embodying endless differentiation, one not two, or one not the other. Long before Jacques Derrida's formative notion of difference, Gertrude Stein's writings were subjecting things to endless transmutations via repetitive incremental shifts in word and language. Put differently, Stein's compositional methods advanced a new kind of thingly grammar, or a re-ruling and delimiting of poetic language and its systems according to the affective shifting perceptual terrains of consciousness. These ideas are ghosted in Laronge's gesture of anti-portraiture, I am the line itself, a rule or drawing of subjective organisation that is overturned immediately as subject and object become commingled entities within the poem. One is also chips. To again cite Stephen Connor, Laronge's after Stein poems can be read as incipient figurings of thought's desire to encounter in things the objects of its own thinking, including, I would argue, its systems of organisation, order attribution, and its arrangement of relationships between entities and things, that is, its grammars. And so we return to the thinking-writing subject and to after-modernist and post-constructivist responses to various inquiries into thingness that characterise some important strands of modernist poetics, including, in a qualified sense, the poetics of Stein's celebrated object series from her book Tender Buttons, Objects, Food, Rooms. And I want to signal those phenomenological environments by collaging two additional formative instances in 20th century American poetry, William Carlos Williams' maxim, No Ideas But in Things, alongside George Oppen's 1968 collection of Being Numerous, which begins by reterritorialising the words of Martin Heidegger. There are things we live among, and to see them is to know ourselves. Occurrence a part of an infinite series. Martin Harrison is all in my mind here now because he was such a teacher of this kind of phenomenology into the moment of the late 20th century Australian poetic. And Astrid, of course, wrote this manuscript under his tutelage. Ideally, a poetical route map from Stein to Laronge would include pit stops at the Café of the Objectivists. Such a brief paper cannot re-enter bedrock debates about the contributions of modern phenomenology to thinking with things, let alone trace the historical impact of that thinking upon Western modernist and contemporary poetics. But they should be acknowledged, however fleetingly, as a precondition for interrogating early 21st century poetical subjects among things. John Froe valuably critiques, and this is his words, a discourse which flourished early in the last century, the phenomenological reduction, which seeks to bracket things in their singularity, reaching back to the thingness of things to free them from their merely instrumental status in a world of human uses. Froe is deeply suspicious of thinking that gives things dual identity as both utterly unknowable and beyond subjective apprehension, a kind of pure other against which we define ourselves as whole. You can see how potentially reductive that is when it comes to broader concerns of the environment and all of the bodies that that constitute an environment. And as also excessively loaded with interiority and meaning, and thereby possessing a kind of divine ontology that is distinct from intention, representation, figuration, or relation. And he includes William's poetic writing within that tradition. Such ontologies commandeer things into the service of complete subject actualization. O thing, limit of my ontological horizons, Godhead, mirror to my own real, etc. That's my poem about it. Stephen Connor warns of the appropriative sentimentality hovering behind such phenomenologies, and he chooses rather to read things as barometers of perceptual, affective, and conceptual relations. Another footnote here, he was responding to Jane Bennett's amazing work, or interesting, provocative work, Vibrant Matter there. And I wanted to have more of Bennett's voice in this paper, but I didn't feel across her theories enough to put them in. There is a sense in which this battle of thing theory in the last 10 years has been fought out among the boys, slogging it out for themselves, which is why I think Pam, Astrid, and, you know, Via Stein, some kind of feminist genealogy of thingliness, is a very interesting, it sort of provokes and provides a critical methodology with which to speak back into that space. So I'd like to unpack why Connor is so disdainful of Bennett in more detail at a later stage. So Connor warns of the appropriative sentimentality hovering behind such phenomenologies, choosing rather to read things as barometers of perceptual, affective, and conceptual relations. In thinking things, we encounter the space of our own constructivist materialisms, the mobile laboratories of infinitely mutable relations by which we think out and enact our subjectivities. Laronge's poems repeatedly perform the affective materialities and property exchanges of those relations, thereby short-circuiting the hazards of object-cathected divine and originary narratives. And in a different poem she writes, electronics, as in a Greek tragedy, fed through cassette narratives of sex, transformation, war, and deep economy. Gertrude Stein's skewed object portraits make similar forays while sounding the impossibility of material closure, such as that longed for in anthropocentric stories of origin and salvation, something Stein plausibly encoded in her title Portraits and Prayers, which of course gives Laronge's Eating and Speaking its epigraph. The story of objects asserting themselves as things, then, is the story of a changed relation to the human subject, writes Bill Brown, and thus the story of how the thing really names less an object than a particular subject-object relation. Or as John Froe argues persuasively, to call these things, the key and the bump, non-human is to ignore the ways in which human will is translated into things and in which things in turn work as delegates which relay back to us these configurations of human will. Froe is now based at the University of Sydney, in case you're interested in looking up his work. I think he has a lot to offer. Here emerges an ethics of materiality that tries to account for the non-human in ways that are non-appropriative, even as it recognises the linguistic and philosophical limits of that stance toward reality. Day and Night, Your Poems, from the book Authentic Local, which was published in 2010, was written by Pam Brown as a publicly private letter to her friend and collaborator Ken Bolton, to whom it is dedicated. "Here in this poem I'm trying to write to yours," she observes. "My problem is that so many poets start with nature. I'm guilty there too." Brown's transformed epistolary mode explores the notion of poems as dialogics that are circulated as gifts among subjects, and the registers of language in which people address concepts of nature and worldly matter. Countless Things, now this is a different poem of Pam's. I will flick to this and that, but I'm not speaking about that right at this instant. I'm speaking about Day and Night, Your Poems. Countless things, particularly bodies and books, are constellated in self-conscious tableau, which seem to reflect Connor's proposition that thought desires to encounter in things the objects of its own thinking. And Pam writes, "This morning I've placed your book on top of the portable TV set next to this small table. The cover and its spine remind me of its pleasures." With characteristic precision, Brown interrogates the libidinal economies of gifting ideas themselves as and via artworks. Her assemblages keep pointing back to a writing subject's investments in its own geometries of meaning, including its natures and languages. Collections of words and objects are remembered and swapped between people, not as property, but as expressions of collective knowledge and experience that do not originate in any single location. Things and places, drinks, poems, grammars, Rome, are not hoarded in service to a possessive subject's will to populate and describe environments after its own generic designs. Even the home TV set is portable. Objects rather condense momentarily for this subject in that place, or according to diverse configurations of human will, such that place, placement, landscape, and desire are suspect terms open always to doubt and new relations. If Brown observes a proprietorial tendency at work in her speaking subject, she quickly admonishes it. I'm guilty there too. And these conceptual tactics and philosophical scepticisms are explored strikingly in Brown's poem, This and That I Cite Myself, from the book Text Thing, which begins, resting like a relic in a field of meaning, push the rocks around for transformation, gravel, rash, scab, scar, all factors that fall squarely like that. Those well-known codes, public, private, continuum, a surveyor's tripod clacks, the laneway, reduced and framed, is picturesque. Even the rubbish appears artificial. Things like rocks are shown here to transform into landscapes because we push them around, making them occasional relics in a field of meaning. As occurs in Laronge's poems, Brown's objects, like gravel rash, scab, scar, become movable sites. They are laneways or habitats, best understood as passages between, in which subject-object relations are renegotiated perpetually. Objects are like that, suggests Brown. They are reduced, framed, made picturesque, and distinctly non-natural according to the limits of subjective apprehension. Even the rubbish appears artificial. Objects thing up our sense of reality as dialogical habitats in themselves, or scenes of encounter that give form to our subjectivities. This mode of collective or relational aesthetics, both collecting and collectivist, recognises objects such as they are, not as numinous entities somehow transcending us and our subjecthood, but as we relate to them, make them and become them. Nicolas Bouriard's recent theories of relationality are apposite here. He writes, unlike an object that is closed in on itself by the intervention of a style and a signature, present-day art shows that form only exists in the encounter and in the dynamic relationship enjoyed by an artistic proposition with other formations, artistic or otherwise. Forms are developed, one from the other. One is also chips. The object-focused poems of Pam Brown and Astrid Laronge explore kinds of radical materialism encountered at the boundaries between things and forms as they morph into one another. Both writers innovate within these prolific borders. Poem as simultaneously public and private exchange. Poem as dedicated event. Poem as translated swarm. Poem as chips. As Brown attests, things challenge us to take account of the planet's fields and our own role in forming them. Thinking with things can remind us that borders are not static, unknowable or legislatively unassailable, but perpetually full and transformative and open to abandonments of signature in favour of gift, places or habitats where we might negotiate a collective ethical response to the materials and things by which we are surrounded and with which we surround ourselves. Thank you. That's the paper. But what I might do now is move to the poem I wrote instead of the paper when I was supposed to be writing the paper, and I slightly foolishly agreed to this commission on poetry with no time to do it. And I used that as an exercise in constraint. I said to myself, I'll write a poem as though I'm writing a letter to Pam, because I'm reading a poem about her letters to other poets, and I'll give myself 60 minutes. And I started writing at 9:27 and finished at 10:27. And this is what emerged. When one becomes a parent, this is all one can clutch at. Okay, so here is Thinking with Things for Pam Brown. You don't need to read it as some rarefied object that we're reading closely together. I just wanted to show you the object, because it's doing the same thinking, of course, as the paper, but this is the form of it. Thinking with Things for Pam Brown, our time starts now. Here under home skies, I'm reflecting on your question, why are there things rather than nothing? Longing provokes a list, a poetry gift catalogue starred with perishables. drifts of privet like improvised walks, apple trees knotting to fractal profusion. Is that the same as improvisation? And silvered by lichen that appears only in winter when the sulphur-crested cockatoos rifling for bitter fruits have gone. The pines are listing to the north, defying weather. Spruce needles are a million candles sprouting from bones. You'd write old, old, old to describe this material endurance. I can hear them again, those cockatoos. I bet you don't want to miss them. Botany attracts me. I think it's because of my compulsion to make lists. Bulbs planted, birds seen, music played during milk cloudy months after both babies arrived. Whoever is a solitary walker these days, I could list the particulars. The walks you detail are teeming with humanity. Some people visit the places loved by those they admire to walk where they did. My friend Tom is walking after Sebald this week. I stepped outside the stomach of Westminster to find the gravestone of Aphra Behn, but I don't know if she ever walked there. We love things so much that listing each one allows it to arrive permanently. Peeling shutters. Either somebody isn't serious about keeping out light or your aesthetic radar is suspicious about objects in which we invest sentimentality. I find myself wanting anxiously to invest in something, still fired up about belief and sequined things. I used to walk near St. Stephen's Cemetery past graffiti warning, "Do not frolic." Authority like that is fine by me. I just can't stand shutting out light selectively. Bombarded by socially mediated data, the scale of resistance seems unfathomable, and we undertake forgetting. Another currawong. My clock would be mountain-shaped with a bird at every hour and feathers for hands. Instead of permanent arrival, you write continuous rediscovery. This is flawless optimism, a philosophy of things and how we encounter them. Adore some, chastise others, collect a few, and forget why they're important to us. Susan Stewart writes that collections overwhelm specifics, or more accurately, a collection starts to redraw the limits of each hoarded item so it becomes charged with our stories about its potential. Burning futures, old, old pasts. Collections share a kind of resistance. We survived, felt purpose, kindled our love and loss among featureless days. Then time never runs out. It returns in another morphology, another group of eyes sweeping the same plane, a different set of lungs. Your words open and close this morning hour. Why things rather than nothing? Nobody knows, but it is better that way. Thanks very much for listening.